governments, conservative and liberal, have used the funding power over NGOs to discipline them politically, to bring them into line. From 1975, when they cut funding to the CCIC, to 1979, when they cut funding to the Canadian University Service Overseas, which is the biggest NGO in Canada at that time, they cut all funding to that and really reorganized it. You know, and throughout the 80s, there were a number of examples as well that we talked about in the book. So, I mean, this idea that Harper is doing something new and different is really false. He's doing maybe what other governments have done in the past in a more extreme and more brazen way, although even that's debatable. But there's nothing, there's no new ground being fundamentally broken here. And so I think that that kind of historical amnesia is really important to contest. And so what this means is, you know, the best case scenario is that development NGOs are really limited. There are strong political limits on what they can do, who they can work with, and what they can criticize. And especially when it comes to criticizing Canadian corporate interests and Canada's foreign policy and how it harms countries in the global south, like in the case of Haiti, or like in the case of the war in Afghanistan, there are real hard limits to what they can do and how much they can fight against these factors. In the worst cases, NGOs have really become kind of absorbed, become participants in imperial adventures of the Canadian government. They become extensions of the state in countries like Afghanistan that are occupied by Canadian troops, and they become partisans. They become party to these counterinsurgency wars, and they become, you know, part of. They become elements on the ground that are used to basically persuade the local population to accept the foreign occupation, to accept Canada's military presence. And so then they're not just kind of doing a limited amount of good, they're really actively perpetuating the harm that I feel we have to fight against if we're serious about, you know, creating a just world.
Could you speak to the example of Haiti? You know, how did these NGOs, how would you describe their activity in the context of the 2004 coup that saw Aristide removed and an interim government put in place, right through to the earthquake relief?
Yeah. Well, the NGOs were really integral in that whole episode. Basically, Aristide was elected in 2000 with a huge majority, and he was elected in large part because of his, you know, his opposition, his longstanding opposition to neoliberal policies, in particular the demand that the government privatize its state enterprises, which provided a lot of the budget of the government. And so when this happened in 2000, really from the get-go, the United States joined forces with Canada and with France to destabilize the government. And they did this a number of ways. They did this through military funding a military kind of contra force in the Dominican Republic, composed of former members of the military, which had been disbanded by Aristide. And they also did this through funding NGOs. And this is talked about a lot in the book, is how millions upon millions of dollars were funneled into this so-called civic opposition to Aristide, which was kind of worked in parallel with the political opposition, but was supposed to be independent and acting in the interests of civil society, speaking for civil society. Mm-hmm. Uniformly across the board during the 2000 to 2004 period, Canadian NGOs were working with anti-Aristide, anti-Lavalas NGOs, Haitian NGOs on the ground. That I have yet to find any real exceptions to that, which is stunning when you consider that these are organizations that are supposed to be working with the poor. And we know in Haiti in the 2000 elections, overwhelmingly the poor voted for Lavalas. And so you have, you know, these Canadian NGOs there funding a civil society, a popular movement, you know, in some cases they even use that language, which was completely unrepresentative of the poor and of the population that they claim to be defending.
And yeah, so, I know a couple of the examples that come to mind are Alternative, yes, and Development and Peace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they basically are... Strangely, I mean, contrary to what you would tend to think, or what their donors would tend to think, they're working against the public interest, the popular interest. Maybe, could you possibly, you know, explain how it is that these sorts of networks, and I imagine that most of them are feel more solidarity with the poor than with these sort of imperial interests, how they get sort of turned around into actually serving these imperial interests?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated story when you look at the history of it, but in essence, it's very simple. You know, these organizations, whether it's Alternatives or Development and Peace, over the years became more and more dependent on government funding, on CETA funding. And when you want to work in a country like Haiti, in the context from 2000 to 2004, if you wanted to have projects there, you had to be working with someone who was part of the opposition. You know, if you were working with someone who happened to be sympathetic to the government, you wouldn't be getting funding any longer. That seems to be clear. So that really, you know, fundamentally, kind of for us, it demonstrated just how, you know, for myself and my co-author, how tied development NGOs had become to Canadian foreign policy interests, and how destructive that really could be. Because, I mean, we're talking about, you know, these are projects that were supposed to be, you know, capacity building. They all had very benign names, right? You know, looking through the projects that Development and Peace was funding in Haiti from 2000 to 2004, you know, capacity building, women's rights, and so on and so forth. And it's all, you know, like, yeah, great. Who could be against that, you know? Like, and then you look at it a little more and it's like, well, it's capacity building for networks of organizations that were saying we should overthrow the democratically elected government, you know, and this is supposed to be democracy promotion. You know, this was done under the rubric of democracy promotion. This is done under the rubric of supporting civil society, you know, and it's like, okay, yeah, you're supporting civil society, but you're supporting a very particular segment of it, which isn't necessarily representative of the whole country. And you know, doing it in a way that is supposed to be apolitical, that is supposed to be kind of neutral, that in fact is at its core deeply political.
How did the NGO movement disrupt the anti-globalization movement?
We spent a whole chapter talking about this, and the NGOs, I'm not sure if they disrupted it so much as they kind of, at many different turns, sought to channel the energies of the movement in kind of non-threatening
directions.
Sort of
co-opt it, you mean?
Yeah, co-opt a lot of that energy and to really redirect it into channels that were non-threatening to the powers that be.
Would be an example of that.
One of the things that came out, it really started with the APEC summits. The APEC summit in Vancouver in 1997, where the government, you know, decided to fund sort of a coalition of NGOs to hold an alternatives people summit. You know, so they knew that the protests were happening. They knew that there was going to be this opposition. And the government, you know, provided, I think, $100,000 for a bunch of NGOs and a few labor unions to put on a people summit. And, you know, it was one of these occasions where they gave voice to the mildest critics of the free trade agreements that were being debated at the time. You know, people who were saying, oh yeah, well, let's include you know, side agreements in these like trade deals so that, you know, we can protect the environment or we can protect labor, when the whole orientation of the deal is to enshrine corporate interests.
These are transnational, basically the masters of transnational business and industry have engineered it, and then it's like you're looking to somehow get the these NGOs and these sort of left labor and environmental groups to kind of give it their stamp of approval. So
yeah, right? You know, and add some sort of, you know, rider, some sort of clause saying, you know, oh, okay, we'll try to, you know, respect the environment, or I'll try to not, you know, horribly exploit workers, something like that. And, you know, and this was really a way of kind of drawing at least an attempt to draw away energy from the more radical groups who are calling not just for press releases to be written about how awful this is, but to actually go out into the street and blockade the event. Because in this case, Jean Chrétien was meeting with General Suharto, the dictator of Indonesia at the time. And so there was very good reasons to, kind of reject this idea of Canada signing any kind of a trade agreement with governments like this, governments that were, very repressive and undemocratic. And,
Should we be looking at alternatives to this NGO model, or should we be trying to focus on reforming existing ones?
Yeah, I think the big conclusion that I came to in writing the book, I felt like I had an open mind about it. I wasn't sure when I started, but the conclusion for me was that clearly, like, this can't be reformed. In the sense that organizations, as long as they depend on funding from the government for such a large share of their budget, they're not going to be able to address those structural causes of poverty, those root causes of poverty that Canada is implicated in. So, we're talking about Canadian mining companies displacing Indigenous people or despoiling the environment, whether we're talking about Canadian corporations in Haiti, utilizing sweatshop labor, this kinds of things. They're only going to be able to critique it up to a certain point. And really, when you start looking at, the true nature of Canada's foreign policy, which is fundamentally imperialist in my view, you need to be able to struggle against it. You need to be able to call it out for what it is and to organize people to fight against it. And I think the way to go is to build independent organizations, broad-based organizations that are truly independent, truly non-governmental, and able to challenge the state and able to challenge corporate interests.
Well, I do see something of an analog here, because we are independent. We don't depend on corporate support. We don't depend on government support. So that has freed us up to cover this sort of subject. And so when you have commercial media depending on advertiser dollars, when you have, CBC depending on money from the state, then there is a certain, he who pays the piper calls the tune kind of arrangement. And so I guess I do see something of an analog there with, these aid agencies.
Yeah, no, and I think supporting independent media is vitally important to questions of international solidarity. If we really want to understand what's going on, it's going to be through the independent media. It's not going to be through the corporate press, because what was happening in Haiti was there was a total blackout, or worse, outright lies being printed in the Canadian press during the coup years, during the 2004-2006 period. And it was really only through independent radio and through independent magazines and websites that we were able to get this information out. So yeah, I think it's vitally important to support radio stations like this.
Thanks a lot. So the book is Paved with Good Intentions, Canada's Development NGOs from Idealism to Imperialism. Nick Barry-Shaw, I want to thank you for coming on the show and telling us more about this very important subject.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Doing the research kind of opened my eyes to a really hopeful reality, which was that in Canada, there's a long kind of rich tradition of international solidarity work that was done outside of the NGOs in a lot of cases. That was grassroots, and that reached broad swaths of the Canadian public. I think in particular of the solidarity movement with Nicaragua after the Sandinista revolution. Just to one example, there's an organization that was founded in 1981 called Tools for Peace. They had chapters all across the country, and by the mid-80s, they were sending down $1 million a year in aid to support the Sandinistas against the Contras and against the U.S. war that was being waged against them. And so, it seems clear to me that if we can find ways on the left of organizing broadly, giving people outlets for that kind of desire to act in solidarity with people especially when they're inspired by things like the Sandinista revolution. I think you know, it's quite possible to do this kind of work, you know, independently of government funding, independently of charitable status, and to do it in a radical way that really is able to criticize what the Canadian government is doing, what Canadian corporate interests are doing abroad. And so I'll leave it at that. I'll close with the idea, you know, that basically internationalism is too important to be left with the NGOs. So if you have any questions, thank you.